his claws out or anything.
He's got claws?
As long as she didn't annoy him too much, he probably wouldn't waste time killing her.
What about Airhaven?
I suppose if it's really badly damaged, it'll put down somewhere for repairs. Tom nodded. Then a happy thought occurred to him.
Do you think Miss Fang'll come after us?
I don't know, said Hester. But Shrike will. Tom looked over his shoulder again, horrified.
Still, she said, at least we're heading in the right direction for London.
He peered gingerly over the edge of the basket. The clouds lay below them like a white eiderdown drawn across the land, hiding anything that might give a clue as to where they were or where they were going.
How can you tell? He asked.
From the stars, of course, said Hester.
Mum showed me. She was an aviator too, remember? She'd been all over the place. She even went to America once. You have to use the stars to find your way in places like that, where they don't have charts or landmarks. Look, that's the Pole Star, and that constellation is what the ancients used to call the Great Bear, but most people nowadays call it the City. And if we keep that one to starboard, we'll know we're heading northeast.
There are so many, he said, trying to follow her pointing finger. Here, above the clouds, without veils of city smoke and out-country dust to hide it, the night sky sparkled with a million cold points of light.
I never knew there were so many stars before. They're all suns, burning away far out in space, thousands and thousands of miles away, said Hester.
And Tom had the feeling that she felt proud to show him how much she knew.
Except for the ones that aren't really stars at all. Some of the really bright ones are mechanical moons that the ancients put up into orbit thousands of years ago, still circling and circling the poor old Earth.
Tom stared up at the glittering dark.
And what's that one?
He asked, pointing to a bright star low in the west. Hester looked at it, and her smile faded away. He saw her hands clench into fists.
That one, she said, that's an airship, and it's coming after us.
Perhaps Miss Fang has come to rescue us, said Tom hopefully. But the distant airship was gaining quickly, and in another few minutes they could see that it was a small London-built scout ship, a Spudbury Sunbeam, or a Goshawk 90. They could almost feel Shrike's green eyes watching them across the deserts of the sky. Hester started fumbling with the rusty wheels and levers that controlled the gas pressure in the balloon. After a few seconds, she found the one she wanted, and a fierce hiss came from somewhere overhead.
"What are you doing?" squeaked Tom. "You'll let the gas out. We'll crash." "I'm hiding us from Shrike," said the girl, and she opened the valve still farther.
Looking up, Tom saw the gas bag start to sag. He glanced back at the pursuing airship. It was gaining, but it was still a few miles away. Hopefully from that distance it would look as if some accident had struck the balloon. Hopefully Shrike would not guess Hester's plan. Hopefully his little ship was not armed with rocket projectors. And then they sank down into the clouds and could see nothing but swirling dark billows, and sometimes a quick glimpse of the moon scudding dimly above them. The basket creaked, and the envelope flapped, and the gas valve hissed like a tetchy snake.
"When we touch down, get out of the basket as quick as you can," said Hester.
"Yes," he said. And then,
"But you mean we're going to leave the balloon?" "We don't stand a chance against Shrike in the air," she explained. "Hopefully, on the ground, I can outwit him."
"On the ground?" cried Tom. "Oh, not the out-country again!" The balloon was sinking fast. They saw the black landscape looming up below, dark blots of vegetation, and a few thin glimmers of moonlight. Overhead, thick clouds were racing into the east. There was no sign of Shrike's airship. Tom braced himself. The ground was 100 feet below, then 50, then 10. Branches came rattling and scraping along the keel, and the basket bucked and plunged, crashing against muddy earth and leaping up into the sky, and down again, and up.
Jump! Screamed Hester the next time it touched down. He jumped, falling through scratchy branches into a soft mattress of mud. The balloon shot upward again, and for a moment he was afraid that Hester had abandoned him to perish on the bare earth. Hester! He shouted, so loud it hurt his throat. Hester! And then there was a rustling in the scrub away to his left, and she was limping toward him.
Oh, thank Quirk, he whispered.
He expected her to stop and sit down with him to rest a while and thank the gods for dropping them onto soft, wet earth instead of hard stone. Instead, she walked straight past him, limping away toward the northeast.
Stop!
Shouted Tom, still too winded and shivery to even stand.
Wait! Where are you going?
She looked back at him as if he were mad.
London, she said.
Tom rolled onto his back and groaned, gathering his strength for another weary trek. Above him, freed of their weight, the balloon was returning to the sky, a dark teardrop that was quickly swallowed into the belly of the clouds. A few moments later, he heard the purr of engines as Shrike's airship went hurrying after it. Then there were only the night and the cold wind, and rags of moonlight prowling the broken hills. Chapter 14. The Guild Hall. Catherine decided to start at the top. The day after her father left London, she sent a message up the pneumatic tube system to the Lord Mayor's office from the terminal in her father's room, and half an hour later, a reply came back from Crome's secretary. The Lord Mayor would see Miss Valentine at noon. Catherine went to her dressing room and put on her most businesslike clothes, her narrow black trousers and her grey coat with the shoulder fins. She tied back her hair with a clip made from the taillights of an ancient car and fetched out a stylish hat with trailing ear flaps that she had bought 6 weeks before but hadn't got around to wearing yet. She put colour on her lips and soft oblongs of rouge high on her cheekbones, and painted a little blue triangle between her eyebrows, a mock guild mark like the fashionable ladies wore. She found a notebook and a pencil, and slipped them both into one of Father's important-looking black briefcases, along with the pass he had given her on her 15th birthday, the gold pass that allowed her access to almost every part of London. Then she studied her appearance in the mirror, imagining herself a few weeks from now going to meet the returning expedition. She would be able to tell Father, "It's all right now. I understand everything. You needn't be afraid anymore." At 11:45, she walked with Dog to the elevator station in Quirk Circus, enjoying the looks that people gave her as she passed. "There goes Miss Catherine Valentine," she imagined them saying. "Off to see the Lord Mayor." The elevator staff all knew her face, and they smiled and said, "Good morning, Miss Catherine," and patted Dog and didn't bother looking at her pass as she boarded the 11:52 for top tier. The elevator hummed upward. She walked briskly across Paternoster Square, where Dog stared thoughtfully at the wheeling pigeons and pricked up his ears at the sounds of the repair work going on inside St. Paul's. Soon she was climbing the steps of the guild hall and being ushered into a tiny internal elevator. And at 11:55, she was shown through the circular bronze door of the Lord Mayor's private office.
"Ah, Miss Valentine, you are 1 minute early."
Crome glanced up at her from the far side of his huge desk and went back to the report that he had been reading. Behind his head was a round window with a view of St. Paul's, looking wavery and unreal through the thick glass, like a sunken temple seen through clear water. Sunlight shone dimly on the tarnished bronze panels of the office walls. There were no pictures, no hangings or decorations of any sort, and the floor was bare metal. Catherine shivered, feeling the cold rise up through the soles of her shoes. The Lord Mayor kept her waiting for 59 silent seconds that seemed to stretch on forever. She was feeling thoroughly uncomfortable by the time he set down the report. He smiled faintly, like somebody who had never seen a smile
but had read a book on how to do it.
You will be glad to hear that I have just received a coded radio signal sent from your father's expedition shortly before he flew out of range, he said. All is well aboard the 13th floor elevator.
Good, said Catherine, knowing that it would be the last she would hear of father until he was on his way home. Even the engineers had never been able to send radio signals more than a few hundred miles.
Was there anything else?
Asked Chrome. Yes, said Catherine, and hesitated, afraid that she was going to sound foolish. Faced with Chrome's cold office and still colder smile, she found herself wishing she had not put on so much makeup or worn these stiff, formal clothes. But this was what she had come here for, after all. She blurted out,
I want to know about that girl, and why she tried to kill my father.
The Lord Mayor's smile vanished.
Your father has never seen fit to tell me who she is. I have no idea why she is so keen to murder him.
Do you think it is something to do with Medusa?
Chrome's gaze grew a few degrees colder.
That matter does not concern you, he snapped. What has Valentine told you?
Nothing, said Catherine, getting flustered. But I can see he's scared, and I need to know why, because—
Listen to me, child, said Chrome,
standing up and coming around the desk at her. Thin hands gripped her shoulders.
If Valentine has secrets from you, it is for good reason. There are aspects of his work that you could not begin to understand. Remember, he started out with nothing. He was a mere out-country scavenger before I took an interest in him. Do you want to see him reduced to that again, or worse?
Catherine felt as if he had slapped her. Her face burned red with anger, but she controlled herself.
Go home and wait for his return, ordered Chrome, and leave grown-up matters to those who understand them. Don't speak to anyone about the girl or Medusa.
Grown-up matters, thought Catherine angrily. How old does he think I am?
But she bowed her head and said meekly,
Yes, Lord Mayor, and Come along, dog.
And do not bring that animal to top tier again, called Chrome,
his voice following her into the outer office, where the secretaries turned to stare at her furious, tearful face. Riding the elevator back to Quirk Circus, she whispered in her wolf's ear,
We'll show him, dog.
Instead of going straight home, she called in at the Temple of Cleo on the edge of Circle Park. There, in the scented darkness, she calmed herself and tried to work out what to do next. Ever since Nicholas Quirk had been declared a god, most Londoners had stopped giving much thought to the older gods and goddesses, and so Catherine had the temple to herself. She liked Cleo, who had been her mother's goddess back in Puerto Angeles, and whose statue looked a bit like Mama too, with its kind dark eyes and patient smile. She remembered what Mama had taught her, about how the poor goddess was being blown constantly backward into the future by the storm of progress, but how she could reach back sometimes and inspire people to change the whole course of history. Looking up now at the statue's gentle face, she said,
What must I do, Cleo? How can I help Father if the Lord Mayor won't tell me anything?
She hadn't really expected an answer, and none came, so she said a quick prayer for Father, and another for poor Tom Natsworthy, and made her offerings and left. It wasn't until she was halfway back to Cleo House that the idea struck her, a thought so unexpected that it could have been sent to her by the goddess herself. She remembered how, as she ran toward the waste chutes on the night Tom fell, she had passed someone heading in the other direction, a young apprentice engineer, looking so white and shocked that she was sure he must have witnessed what happened. She hurried homeward through the sunlit park. That young engineer would have the answer. She would go back to the gut and find him.
She would find out what was going on without any help from wicked old Magnus Chrome.
Chapter 15. The Rustwater Marshes. Tom and Hester had walked all night, and when the pale, flat sun rose behind drifts of morning fog, they kept walking, stopping only now and then to catch their breaths. This landscape was quite different from the mud plains they had crossed a few days ago. Here they had to keep making detours around bogs and pools of brackish water, and although they sometimes stumbled into the deep, weed-choked scars of old town tracks, it was clear that no town had been this way for many years.
"See how the scrub has grown up," said Hester, pointing out ruts filled with brambles and hillsides green with young trees. "Even a little semi-static would have felled those saplings for fuel."
"Perhaps the earth here is just too soft," suggested Tom, sinking to his waist for the 20th time in the thick mud.
He was recalling the huge map of the hunting ground that hung in the lobby of the London Museum, and the great sweep of marsh country that stretched all the way from the central mountains to the shores of the Sea of Kazakh, mile after mile of reed beds and thin blue creeks, and all of it marked unsuitable for town or city.
He said, "I think this must be the edge of the Rustwater Marshes. They call it that because the water is supposed to be stained red with the rust of towns that have strayed into it and sunk. Only the most foolhardy mayor would bring his town here."
"Then Rayland and Anner Fang brought us much farther south than I thought," whispered Hester to herself. "London must be almost 1,000 miles away by now.
It'll take months to catch it up again, and Shrike will be on my tail the whole way."
"But you fooled him," Tom reminded her. "We escaped."
"He won't stay fooled for long," she said. "He'll soon pick up our tracks again. Why do you think he's called a stalker?"
On and on she led him, dragging him over hills and through mires and down valleys where the air was speckly with swarms of whining, stinging flies. They both grew weary and peevish. Once, Tom suggested they sit down and rest a while, and Hester snapped back,
"Do what you like, what do I care?"
After that, he trudged on in silence, angry at her. What a horrible, ugly, vicious, self-pitying girl she was. After all they had come through, and the way he had helped her in the outcountry, she was still ready to abandon him. He wished Shrike had gotten her, and it was Miss Fang or Cora whom he had escaped with. They would have let him rest his aching feet. But he was glad enough of Hester when the darkness fell, when thick clots of fog rose out of the marshes like the ghosts of mammoths, and every rustle in the undergrowth sounded like a stalker's footfall. She found a place for them to spend the night, in the shelter of some stunted trees, and later, when the sudden shriek of a hunting owl brought him leaping out of his uneasy sleep, he found her sitting guard beside him, like a friendly gargoyle.
"It's all right," she told him.
And after a moment, in one of those sudden flashes of softness that he had noticed before, she said,
"I miss them, Tom. My mum and dad."
"I know," he said. "I miss mine, too."
"You've got no family at all in London?"
"No."
"No friends?"
He thought about it.
"Not really."
"Who was that girl?"
she asked after a little while.
"What? Where?"
"In the gut that night, with you and Valentine."
"That was Catherine," he said.
She's Valentine's daughter."
Hester nodded. "She's pretty," she said. After that he slept easier, dreaming that Catherine was coming down to rescue them in an airship, carrying them back into the crystal light above the clouds. When he next opened his eyes, it was dawn, and Hester was shaking him.
"Listen!"
He listened, and heard a sound that was not the sound of woods or water.
"Is it a town?"
he asked hopefully.
"No."
Hester tilted her head to one side, tasting the sound.
"It's a Rutvang aero engine." It grew louder, throbbing down out of the sky. Above the swirling mist, a London scout ship flickered by. They froze, hoping that the wet, black cage of branches overhead would hide them. The growl of the airship faded, and then rose again, circling.
"Shrike can see us,"
whispered Hester, staring up at the blind white fog.
"I can feel him watching us."
"No, no," Tom insisted. "If we can't see the airship, how can he see us? It stands to reason."
But high overhead, the resurrected man tunes his eyes to ultra-red and switches on his heat sensors and sees two glowing human shapes amid the soft grey static of the trees.
"Take me closer,"
he orders.
"If you can see them so clearly now," the airship's pilot grumbles, "it's a pity you couldn't tell that bloomin' balloon was empty before we went chasing it across half the hunting ground."
Shrike says nothing. Why should he explain himself to this whining once-born? He had seen that the balloon was empty as soon as it popped back up above the clouds, but he had decided to keep it to himself. He was pleased at Hester Shaw's quick thinking, and he decided to let her live a few more hours as a reward, while this slow-witted engineer-aviator pursued her empty balloon. He flicks his eyes back to their normal setting. He will hunt Hester the hard way, with scent and sound and ordinary vision. He calls up a memory of her face and sets it turning in his mind as the airship sweeps down through the fog.
"Run!"
said Hester. The airship loomed out of the whiteness a few yards away, settling toward the ground with its rotors beating the fog like egg whisks. She hauled Tom out of their useless hiding place and away across sodden ground, knuckled with tree roots. White scuts of water spurted at every step, and black slime gurgled into their boots. They ran blindly until Hester came to such an abrupt stop that Tom crashed into her from behind, and they both went sprawling. They had come in a circle. The airship hung just ahead of them, and a giant shape barred their path. Two beams of pale green light stabbed toward them, filled with dancing water droplets.
"Hester,"
grated a metal voice. Hester groped for something she could use as a weapon, and came up with a gnarled old length of wood.
"Don't come any closer, Shrike," she warned. "I'll smash those pretty green eyes of yours. I'll bash your brains out."
"Come on,"
squeaked Tom, plucking at her coat and trying to drag her away.
"Where to?"
asked Hester, risking a quick glance back at him. She shifted her grip on the makeshift club and stood her ground as Shrike stalked closer.
"You have done well, Hester, but the hunt is ended."
The stalker was moving carefully over the wet ground. Each time he set down his metal foot, a wreath of steam hissed up. He raised his hands, and claw-like blades slid out.
"What made you change your mind about London, Shrike?" shouted Hester angrily. "How'd you come to be Chrome's odd-job man?"
"You led me to London, Hester."
Shrike paused, and his dead face widened in a steely smile.
"I knew you would go there. I sold my collection and chartered an airship so that I could get there before you."
"You sold your clockwork people?"
Hester sounded astonished.
"Shrike, if you wanted me back that badly, why didn't you just track me down?"
"I decided to let you cross the hunting ground alone,"
said Shrike.
"It was a test."
"Did I pass?"
Shrike ignored her.
"When I reached London, I was taken straight to the Engineerium, as I expected. I spent 18 months there waiting for you to arrive. The engineers took me apart and put me together again 12 times. But it was worth it. I made a deal with Magnus Chrome. He has promised me my heart's desire.
Oh, good, said Hester weakly, wondering what on earth he was talking about.
But first, you must die.
But, Shrike, why? The reply was drowned out by a thick, warbling hum that made Tom wonder if the Stalker's airship was about to lift off without him. He glanced up at it. It was still holding the same position as before, but the steady chirrup of the propellers had been masked by the new noise, a rumbling, slithering roar that grew louder every second. Even Shrike seemed disturbed. His eyes flickered, and he tilted his head to one side, listening. Underfoot, the ground began to tremble. Out of the fog behind the Stalker burst a wall of mud and water, curling over at the top, capped with white foam. Behind it came a town, a very small, old-fashioned town, racing along on 8 fat wheels. Hester scrambled backward, and Shrike saw the look on her face and turned to see what caused it. Tom dived sideways, grabbing the girl by the scruff of her neck and hurling her to safety. The airship tried to veer away, but the wheels of the speeding town caught it and blew it apart and plowed the blazing debris down into the mud. An instant later, they heard the Stalker bellow, "Hester!" as the huge front wheel came crashing down on him. They clung together, rolling over and over as the town howled past, a flicker of spokes and pistons, firelight on metal, tiny figures staring down from observation decks, the long, drawn-out moan of a klaxon echoing through the fog. Then, just as suddenly as it had appeared, it was gone. The air stank of smoke and hot metal. They sat up. Bits of airship were drifting down, blazing merrily. Where the Stalker had been standing, a deep wheel mark was quickly filling with black, glistening mud. Something that might have been an iron hand jutted from the ooze, and a pale cloud of steam rose into the air above it, and slowly faded.
"Is it dead?"
asked Tom, his voice all quivery with fright.
"A town just ran over him," said Hester. "I shouldn't think he's very well."
Tom wondered dimly what Shrike had meant about his heart's desire. Why would he have sold his precious collection to come after Hester if all he wanted to do was kill her? There was no way of knowing now.
"And the poor men on that airship," he whispered.
"They were sent to help him kill us, Natsworthy," said the girl. "Don't waste your pity on them."
They were quiet for a moment, staring at the mist. Then Tom said,
"I wonder what it was running from."
"What do you mean?"
"That town," said Tom. "It was moving so fast, something must be chasing it."
Hester looked at him and slowly realized what he meant.
"Oh, knackers," she said. The second town was upon them almost at once. It was bigger than the first, with vast barrel-shaped wheels. On its gaping jaws, some wag had drawn a toothy grin and the words, "Happy Eater." There was no time to run out of its way. Hester grabbed Tom this time, and he saw her shouting something, but the shrieking thunder of the engines meant that it took him a moment to work out what it was.
"We can jump it. Do as I do."
The town rolled over them, its wheels passing on either side so that they were lifted up like 2 ants in the path of a plough, lifted on a wave of mud that almost smashed them against the lumbering metal belly overhead. Hester crouched on the crest of the wave like a surfer, and Tom wobbled beside her, expecting at any moment to be swatted out of his life by a passing derrick or hurled under the wheels. Hester was shouting at him again and pointing. an exhaust duct was rushing past them like a monstrous snake, and by the flare of furnace light from vents on the town's underside, he made out the handrail of a maintenance platform. Hester grabbed at it and swung herself up, and Tom flung himself after her. For a moment, his hands clutched wildly at nothing. Then there was rusty iron under his fingers, almost jerking his arms from their sockets, and Hester reached down and took a firm grip on his belt and hauled him to safety. It was a long time before they stopped shaking and clambered to their feet. They both looked as if they had been modelled crudely from the out-country mud. It covered their clothes and clagged in their hair and plastered their faces. Tom was laughing helplessly at the closeness of their escape and at the sheer surprise of finding himself still alive, and Hester laughed with him. He had never heard her laugh before, and he had never felt as close to anyone as he felt to her at that moment.
"We'll be all right," she said. "We'll be all right now. Let's go up and find out whom we've hitched a lift with."
Whatever the town was, it was small, only a suburb, really. Tom amused himself by trying to work out what it might be while Hester picked the lock on a hatchway and led him up a long stairwell with rusty walls that steamed in the heat from the engines. He thought it looked a bit like Crawley, or Purley Spokes, the suburbs that London had built back in the great old days when there was so much prey that cities could afford to build little satellite towns. If so, it might have its own merchant airships, licensed to trade with London. But something still nagged at the back of his mind. Only the most foolhardy mayor would bring his town here. Why on earth would Crawley or Purley Spokes be chasing a townlet into the dreaded Rustwater marshes? They climbed on up the stairwell until they reached a second hatch. It wasn't locked, and swung open to let them out onto the upper deck. A cold wind blew fog between the metal buildings, and the deck plates shook and lurched as the suburb raced onward. The streets seemed deserted, but Tom knew that small towns often had only a few hundred inhabitants. Perhaps they were all busy in the engine rooms, or waiting safe indoors until the chase was over. But there was something about this place he didn't like. It certainly wasn't the trim little suburb he had been hoping for. The deck plates were rusty and pitted, and the shabby houses were dwarfed by huge auxiliary engines that had been ripped out of other towns and bolted haphazardly to this one, linked to the main engines on the deck below by a cat's cradle of gigantic ducts that wrapped around the buildings and burrowed down through holes cut in the deck plate. Beyond them, where Tom would have expected parks and observation platforms, a mess of gun emplacements and wooden palisades ringed the edge of the suburb. Hester motioned for him to keep quiet and led him toward the foggy stern, where he could see a tall building that must be the town hall. As they drew nearer, they made out a sign above the entrance that read, "Welcome to Tunbridge Wheels. Population 500. Crossed out. 467, crossed out, 212, and still rising." Above it flapped a black and white flag, a grinning skull, and two crossed bones.
"Great quirk," Tom gasped. "This is a pirate suburb."
And suddenly, from foggy side streets all around them, came men and women as shabby as the town, lean and hard and fierce-eyed, and carrying the biggest guns that he had ever seen. As the pirate suburb speeds on its way, silence returns to the Rustwater, broken only by the sounds of small creatures moving in the reed beds. Then the ooze in one of the deep wheel ruts burbles and heaves and vomits up the jerking wreck of Shrike. He has been driven far down into the mud, like a screaming tent peg, ground and crushed and twisted. His left arm hangs by a few frayed wires. His right leg will not move. One of his eyes is dark and blind, and the view from the other is cloudy, so that he has to keep twitching his head to clear it. Bits of his memory have vanished, but others come up unbidden. As he wades out of the suburb's wheel marks, he remembers the ancient wars that he was built for. At Hill 20, the Tesla guns crackled like iced lightning, wrapping him in fire until his flesh began to fry on his iron bones. But he survived. He is the last of the Lazarus Brigade, and he always survives. It will take a lot more than being run over by a couple of towns to finish Shrike. Slowly, slowly, he claws his way to firmer ground, and sniffs and scouts and scans, until he is sure that Hester escaped alive. He feels very proud of her. His heart's desire. Soon he will find her again, and the loneliness of his everlasting life will be over. The suburb has left deep grooves across the landscape. It will be easy to track, even with his leg dragging uselessly, even with an eye gone and his mind misfiring. The stalker throws back his head and bellows his hunting cry at the empty marshes. Chapter 16. The Turd Tanks. London kept on moving, day after day, grinding its way across the continent formerly known as Europe, as if there were some fantastic prize ahead. But all that the lookouts had sighted since the city ate Salthook were a few tiny scavenger towns, and Magnus Chrome would not even alter course to catch them. People started to grow restless, asking each other in whispers what the Lord Mayor thought he was playing at. London had never been meant to go so far, so fast. There was talk of food shortages, and the heat from the engines spread up through the deck plates until it was said you could fry an egg on the pavements of Tier 6. Down in the gut, the heat was appalling, and when Catherine stepped off the elevator at Tartarus Row, she felt as if she had just walked into an oven. She had never been so deep into the gut before, and for a while she stood blinking on the steps of the elevator terminus, dazed by the noise and darkness. Up on Tier 1, she had left the sun shining down on Circle Park, and a cool wind stirring the rose bushes. Down here, gangs of men were running about, klaxons were honking, and huge hoppers of fuel were grinding past her on their way to the furnaces. For a moment, she felt like going home, but she knew that she had to do what she had come here for Father's sake. She took a deep breath and went out into the street. It was nothing like High London. Nobody knew her face down here. Passers-by were surly when she asked them for directions, and off-duty labourers lounging on the pavements whistled as she went by and shouted, "Hello, darling," and "Where'd you get that hat?" A burly foreman shoved her aside to lead a gang of shackled convicts past. From shrines under the fuel ducts leered statues of Sooty Pete, the hunchbacked god of engine rooms and smokestacks. Catherine lifted her chin and kept a tight grip on Dog's leash, glad that he was there to protect her. But she knew that this was the only place where she could hope to find the truth. With Father away and Tom lost or dead, and Magnus Chrome unwilling to talk, there was only one person left in London who might know the secret of the scarred girl. It had been hard work finding him, but luckily the staff in the records office at the Guild of Salvagemen, Stokers, Wheel Tappers and Associated Gut Operatives were happy enough to oblige Thaddeus Valentine's daughter. If there was an apprentice engineer near the waste chutes that night, they said, he must have been supervising convict labourers. And if he was supervising convict labourers, he must have come from the engineer's experimental prison in the deep gut. A few more questions and a bribe to a gut foreman, and she had a name. Apprentice Engineer Pod. Now, nearly a week after her meeting with the Lord Mayor, she was on her way to talk to him. The Deep Gut Prison was a complex of buildings the size of a small town that clustered around the base of a giant support pillar. Catherine followed signposts to the administration block, a spherical metal building jacked up on rust-streaked gantries and slowly revolving so that the supervisors could look down from its windows and watch their cell blocks and exercise yards and algae mat farms spin endlessly around them. In the entrance hall, neon light glimmered on acres of white metal. An engineer came gliding up to Catherine as she stepped inside.
"No dogs allowed," he said.
"He's not a dog, he's a wolf," replied Catherine with her sweetest smile, and the man jumped back as Dog sniffed at his rubber coat. He was prim-looking, with a thin, pursed mouth and patches of eczema on his bald head. The badge on his coat said, "Gut Supervisor Nimmo." Catherine smiled at him, and before he could raise any more objections, she showed her gold pass and said,
"I'm here on an errand for my father, the head historian. I have to see one of your apprentices, a boy called Pod."
Supervisor Nimmo blinked at her and said,
But
"I've come straight from Magnus Chrome's office," Catherine lied. "Call his secretary if you want to check."
"No, I'm sure it's all right," mumbled Nimmo.
Nobody from outside the guild had ever wanted to interview an apprentice before, and he didn't like it. There was probably a rule against it, but he didn't want to argue with someone who knew the Lord Mayor. He asked Catherine to wait, and he scurried away, vanishing into a glass-walled office on the far side of the hall. Catherine waited, stroking Dog's head and smiling politely at bald, white-coated passers-by. Soon, Nimmo was back.
"I have located Apprentice Pod," he announced. "He has been transferred to Section 60.
"Oh, well done, Mr. Nimmo," Catherine beamed. "Can you send him up?"
"Certainly not,"
retorted the engineer, who wasn't sure he liked being ordered about by a mere historian's daughter. But if she wanted to see Section 60, he would take her there.
"Follow me,"
he said, leading the way to a small elevator.
"Section 60 is on the underdecks."
The underdecks were where London kept its plumbing. Catherine had read about them in her school books, so she was prepared for the long descent. But nothing could have prepared her for the smell. It hit her as soon as the elevator reached the bottom and the door slid open. It was like walking into a wall of wet sewage.
"This is Section 60, one of our most interesting experimental labor units," said Nimmo,
who didn't seem to notice the smell.
"The convicts assigned to this sector are helping to develop some very exciting new ways of recycling the city's waste products."
Catherine stepped out, clamping her handkerchief over her nose. She found herself standing in a huge, dimly lit space. Ahead of her were three tanks, each larger than Clio House and all its gardens. Stinking yellow-brown filth was dribbling into the tanks from a maze of pipes that clung to the low ceiling, and people in drab-grey prison coveralls were wading chest-deep in it, skimming the surface with long-handled rakes.
"What are they doing?" asked Catherine. "What is that stuff?"
"Detritus, Miss Valentine," said Nimmo, sounding proud. "Effluent. Ejecta. Human nutritional byproducts."
"You mean poo?"
said Catherine, appalled.
"Thank you, Miss Valentine. Perhaps that is the word for which I was groping."
Nimmo glared at her.
"There is nothing disgusting about it, I assure you. We all use the toilet from time to time. Well, now you know where your, poo ends up. Waste not, want not, is the engineer's motto, miss. Properly processed, human ordure makes very useful fuel for our city's engines. And we are experimenting with ways of turning it into a tasty and nutritious snack. We feed our prisoners on nothing else. Unfortunately, they keep dying, but that is just a temporary setback, I'm sure."
Catherine walked to the edge of the nearest tank. I have come down to the sunless country, she thought. Oh, Cleo, this is the land of the dead. But even the sunless country could not be as terrible as this place. The slurry swilled and shifted, slapping at the edges of the tanks as London trundled over a range of rugged hills. Flies buzzed in thick clouds beneath the vaulted roof and settled on the faces and bodies of the labourers. Their shaven heads gleamed in the dim half-light, faces set in blank stares as they skimmed the thick crust from the surface and transferred it into hoppers that other convicts wheeled on rails along the sides of the tank. Grim-faced apprentice engineers looked on, swinging long black truncheons. Only Dog seemed happy. He was straining at his leash, his tail wagging, and every now and then he would look up eagerly at Catherine, as if to thank her for bringing him somewhere with such interesting smells. She fought down her rising lunch and turned to Nimmo.
These poor people, who are they?
Oh, don't worry about them, said the supervisor. They're convicts, criminals, they deserve it.
What did they do?
Oh, this and that, petty theft, tax dodging, criticizing our Lord Mayor. They're very well treated, considering. Now, let's see if we can find Apprentice Pod.
While he spoke, Catherine had been watching the nearest tank. One of the men working it had stopped moving and let go of his rake, holding his head as if overcome by dizziness. Now, a girl apprentice had also noticed him, and stepping up to the edge of the tank, she jabbed at the man with her truncheon. Blue sparks flickered where it touched him, and he thrashed and howled and floundered, finally vanishing under the heaving surface. Other prisoners stared toward the place where he had sunk, too scared to go and help.
"Do something," gasped Catherine, turning to Nimmo, who seemed not to have noticed.
Another apprentice came running along the edge of the tank, shouting at the prisoners below him to help their comrade. Two or three of them dredged him up, and the new apprentice leaned down into the tank and hauled him out, splattering himself with slurry in the process. He was wearing a little gauze mask, like many of the warders, but Catherine was sure she recognized him, and at her side she heard Nimmo growl,
"Pod!"
They hurried toward him. Apprentice Pod had dragged the half-drowned convict onto the metal walkway between the tanks, and was trying to wash the slurry from his face with water from a standpipe nearby. The other apprentice, the one who had jabbed the poor man in the first place, looked on with an expression of disgust.
"You're wasting water again, Pod,"
she said as Catherine and Nimmo ran up.
"What is going on here, apprentices?"
asked Nimmo crossly.
"This man was slacking," the girl said. "I was just trying to get him to work a bit faster."
"He's feverish,"
said Apprentice Pod, looking up plaintively, covered in stinking muck.
"It's no wonder he couldn't work."
Catherine knelt beside him, and he noticed her for the first time, his eyes widening in surprise. He had succeeded in washing most of the slurry from the man's face, and she reached out and laid her hand on the damp brow. Even by the standards of the deep gut, it felt hot.
"He's really sick,"
she said, looking up at Nimmo.
"He's burning up. He should be in the hospital."
"Hospital?" replied Nimmo. "We have no hospital down here. These are prisoners, Miss Valentine, criminals. They don't require medical care."
"He'll be another case for K Division soon,"
observed the girl apprentice.
"Be quiet,"
hissed Nimmo.
"What does she mean, K Division?" asked Catherine.
Nimmo wouldn't answer. Apprentice Pod was staring at her, and she thought she saw tears trickling down his face, although it might have been perspiration. She looked down at the convict, who seemed to have slid into a sort of half-sleep. The metal decking looked terribly hard, and on a sudden impulse she pulled off her hat and folded it and slipped it under his head as a pillow.
"He shouldn't be here," she said angrily. "He's far too weak to work in your horrible tanks."
"It's appalling," agreed Nimmo. "The sort of prisoners we are being sent these days are just too feeble. If the Guild of Merchants made more of an effort to solve the food shortage, they might be a bit healthier. Or if the navigators pulled their fingers out and tracked down some decent prey for once. But I think you have seen enough, Miss Valentine. Kindly ask Apprentice Pod whatever it is your father wishes to know, and I shall take you back to the elevators.
Catherine looked at Pod. He had pulled down his mask, and he was unexpectedly handsome, with big dark eyes and a small perfect mouth. She stared at him for a moment, feeling stupid. Here he was, being brave, trying to help this poor man, and she was bothering him with something that suddenly seemed quite trivial.
"It's Miss Valentine, miss, isn't it?"
he said nervously, as Dog pushed past him to sniff at the sick man's fingers. Catherine nodded.
"I saw you in the gut that night, when we ate Salthook," she said, "down by the waste chutes. I think you saw the girl who tried to kill my father. Could you tell me everything you remember?"
The boy stared at her, fascinated by the long, dark strands of hair that were falling down across her face now that her hat was off. Then his eyes flicked away to look at Nimmo.
"I didn't see anything, miss," he said. "I mean, I heard shouting, and I ran to help, but with all the smoke and stuff, I didn't see anybody."
"Are you sure?" pleaded Catherine. "It could be terribly important."
Apprentice Pod shook his head and wouldn't meet her eye.
I'm sorry.
The man on the deck suddenly stirred and gave a great sigh, and they all looked down at him. It took Catherine a moment to understand that he was dead.
"See," said the girl apprentice smugly, "told you he was for K Division."
Nimmo was prodding the body with the toe of his boot.
"Take him away, apprentice."
Catherine was shaking. She wanted to cry, but she couldn't. If only she could do something to help these poor people.
"I'm going to tell my father all about this when he gets home," she promised. "And when he finds out what's going on in this dreadful place..."
She wished she had never come here. Beside her, she heard Pod say again,
"Sorry, Miss Valentine,"
and wasn't sure if he was sorry because he couldn't help her, or sorry for her because she had learned the truth of what life was like under London. Nimmo was growing edgy.
"Miss Valentine, I insist that you leave now. You shouldn't be here. Your father should have sent an official member of his guild if he had business with this apprentice. What did he hope to learn from the boy anyway?"
"I'm coming,"
said Catherine, and did the only thing she could for the dead convict. She reached out and gently shut his eyes.
"I'm sorry,"
whispered Apprentice Pod as they led her away. Chapter 17. The Pirate Suburb. Late that night, and deep in the Rustwater marshes, Tunbridge Wheels finally caught up with its prey. The exhausted townlet had blundered into a sinkhole, and the suburb hit it side-on without bothering to slow its thunderous speed. The impact tore the townlet to pieces, and splinters came raining down into the suburb streets as it turned and sped back to swallow the wreckage.
"Meals on wheels!" the pirates howled.
From their cage in the suburb's gut, Tom and Hester watched in horror as the dismantling engines went to work, ripping the townlet into heaps of scrap without even bothering to let the survivors off. The few who did come stumbling out were grabbed by the waiting pirates. If they were young and fit, they were dragged off to other tiny cages like the one in which Hester and Tom had been imprisoned. If not, they were killed, and their bodies were added to the rubbish heap at the edge of the digestion yard.
"Oh, great quirk," Tom whispered. "This is horrible. They're breaking every rule of municipal Darwinism."
"It's a pirate suburb, Natsworthy," said Hester. "What did you expect? They strip their prey as quickly as they can and make the captives slaves in their engine rooms. They don't waste food and space on people who are too weak to work. It's not really so different from what your precious London gets up to. At least this lot have the honesty to call themselves pirates."
The flash of a crimson robe out in the digestion yards caught Tom's eye. the mayor of the pirate suburb, had come down to take a look at his latest catch, and he was strutting along the walkway outside the cells, surrounded by his bodyguards. He was a tiny little man, stooping and hunch-shouldered, a bald head and scrawny neck jutting from the cat-fur collar of his gown. He didn't look friendly.
"He looks more like a moth-eaten vulture than a mare," whispered Tom, tugging at Hester's sleeve and pointing. "What do you think he'll do with us?"
She shrugged, glancing up at the approaching party.
"We'll be slung into the engine rooms, I suppose."
Then she stopped short, staring at the mare, as if he was the most amazing thing she had ever seen. Shouldering Tom aside, she thrust her face against the bars of the cage and started to shout.
"Peavy!"
she hollered, straining to make herself heard over the thunder of the gut.
"Peavy! Over here!"
"Do you know him?" asked Tom, confused. "Is he a friend? Is he all right?"
"I don't have friends," snapped Hester. "And he's not all right. He's a ruthless, murdering animal, and I've seen him kill people for just looking at him in a funny way. So let's hope the catch has put him in a good mood. Peavy! Over here! It's me! It's Hester Shore!"
The ruthless, murdering animal turned toward their cage and scowled.
"His name's Chrysler Peavy," Hester explained hoarsely. "He stopped to trade in Stroll a couple of times when I lived there with Shrike. He was mayor of another little scavenger town. The gods alone know how he got himself a flash suburb like this. Now hush and let me do the talking."
Tom studied Chrysler Peavy as he came stalking over to peer at the captives, henchmen clustering behind. He wasn't much to look at. His lumpy scalp reflected the glare of furnaces, and the sweat draining off it made pale stripes in the grime on his face. As if to make up for his bald head, he had hair almost everywhere else, grubby white bristles pushing out of his chin, thick grey tufts sprouting from his ears and nostrils, and a pair of enormous, bushy, wriggling eyebrows. A tarnished chain of office hung around his neck, and on one shoulder perched a scrawny monkey.
"Who are they?" he said.
"Couple of hitchhikers, boss. I mean, your worship,"
said one of his guards, a woman whose hair had been plaited and lacquered into two long, curving horns.
"Come aboard in the middle of the chase, your worship,"
added another, the man who had overseen the newcomer's capture. He showed Peavy the coat he was wearing, the fleece-lined aviator's coat he had taken from Tom.
"I got this off one of them, eh?"
Peavy grunted. He seemed about to turn away, but Hester kept grinning her crooked grin at him and saying,
"Peavy, it's me!"
until she lit a spark of recognition in his greedy black eyes.
"Bloody hull!" he growled. "It's the Tin Man's kid!"
"You're looking good, Peavy," said Hester.
And Tom noticed that she didn't try to hide her face from the pirates, as if she knew that she mustn't let them see any sign of weakness.
"Blimey," said Peavy, looking her up and down. "Blimey, it really is you. The Stalker's little helper, all growed up and uglier than ever. Where's old Shrikey, then?"
"Dead," said Hester.
"Dead? What? Was it metal fatigue?"
He gave a great guffaw, and the bodyguards all joined in obediently, until even the monkey on his shoulder started shrieking and rattling its chain.
"Metal fatigue! Get it?"
"So how come you're running Tunbridge Wheels?" asked Hester, while he was still wiping the tears from his eyes and chuckling. "The last I heard of this place, it was a respectable suburb. It used to hunt up north, on the edges of the ice."
Peavy chuckled, leaning against the bars.
"Flashy, innit?" he said. "This place et my old town a couple of years back. Come racing up one day and scoffed it straight down. They were soft, though. They hadn't reckoned with me and my boys. We busted out of the gut and took over the whole place, set the mayor and the council to work.